Have a couple of verses that we'll start off with, just kind of lead us into it. We got partially into chapter 11. The nature of that material is relatively easy to cover. We have a very short 12th chapter, and while there are some difficult things in it, shouldn't really be too much trouble at all for us. Go ahead and wrap up Daniel then here this evening. So let's start, though, all the way back in chapter 7 now. Starting with chapter 7, the last half of these 12 chapters, 7 through 12, are all given over to magnificent prophecies which describe in detail events that lie in the future from just a short distance to hundreds of years ahead. They are then, Daniel chapters 7 through 12, some of the most absolutely faith-building and fortifying passages in all of the Bible. They are of such a nature that those that strive against all things biblical, who are in rebellion to God, you know, whose hearts are hard and will not receive the scriptures as they are intended, have railed against Daniel, as we've said before, because they see such specificity, such minute detail, that as these years unfold through the centuries that bring us up to the time of Christ, it can't possibly be that it could be foretold. They say it must be after the fact. So he's a liar. He lived much later. He's writing stuff that had already happened, claiming to live before that time. You know, Daniel's just a deceiver. Not the case. Now, as a fact, matter of fact, this week, happened to be speaking with Nick Nelson, probably my best friend, I guess, on this earth. I think of him that way. He is a master of all things scriptural, just an amazing Bible student. And he pointed out some of his own manuscript studies that we have, thanks to Dead Sea discoveries, manuscripts that date back at least to about 250 B.C., Daniel certainly writes about quite a few things, you'll see him especially tonight, that are well beyond that. How can he be lying and writing a book after these facts when we find manuscripts that date back to 250 B.C.? You know, it's just impossible. The book was written before the events took place. Daniel is predicting the future because the Spirit of God is giving him the means to do this. So with chapter 7, look just at verses 21 and 22. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Since the second chapter, Nebuchadnezzar and his dream has been told, and we've been learning, as you go especially from 7 and following, the Messiah is coming. This has to be Jesus that we're talking about. And this individual here in verse 21, this horn that's waging war with the saints is, until judgment is passed in favor of those saints, has to do, as we studied, of course, with the time after Christ and his kingdom beginning in Acts chapter 2, but being persecuted, and eventually the saints take possession of the kingdom in the sense that the Jews are utterly annihilated. They're gone. The temple's destroyed. As a people, they're either killed or taken into captivity, scattered to the four winds, never going to have, you know, the same status with God as they've had in the past. So here we have a foretelling in 21 and 22 of the end of these saints in verse 21, which are the Jews, but the continuation of the saints among the Jews who accepted Christ and will then go on down to this very day. Skipping to chapter 8, and now looking at a different historical event. But in Acts chapter 8 and verse 8, remember the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. He's cast down the ram. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. Clearly that's Alexander the Great. And in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. This is a historical fact which will play out long after Daniel's time, where Alexander will die at the age of 33, off in a foreign land. Great general, couldn't hardly be identified as a king at all, since he was gaining, you know, territory, but never really was ruling over it either. And then his wife and his son are murdered. Four generals arise out of all of this chaos. His kingdom is divided into four parts, and that's exactly what takes place, just as it's depicted in chapter 8. We then came to chapter 9. We had 2 weeks where we worked with verses 24 through 27, quite arguably the most difficult verses in all the Old Testament, maybe the New too. Got a lot of questions in there. But please notice in chapter 9, verse 26, after the 62 weeks, Messiah will be cut off. We know Messiah's coming. And so in Daniel's day, it's 500 years away, but the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off to have nothing, the crucifixion. The people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, this again is Titus coming to destroy Jerusalem. Now, Vespasian, his father first, Titus will be the one to wrap it up, his son. And its end will come with a flood. Even at the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. So, again, we're finding out about the conquest of the Jews and the end of their special relationship with God because the Messiah comes. And their end will be terrible. It'll be like a flood. They're going to be annihilated. And we're going to see much of that again here this evening. So, we come into chapter 10. We looked at chapter 10, all of it, last week. It's the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. It's circa around about 534 B.C. And in verses 5 and 6, Daniel sees a great vision that is terribly terrifying for him. I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with pure gold of Uphaz. His body also was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. Starting with chapter 10 through to the end of the book, we have one vision and its explanation. And we will now have chapter 7, 8, and 9 reviewed, if you will, in even greater detail than they were presented before. So the last half of Daniel is all about the time from Daniel to the coming of the Messiah and his crucifixion, and then the 40 years after that, when the Jews will be destroyed. The power of the holy people will be shattered, is what we'll be seeing here in a little bit. And so, very clearly, the whole last half is foretelling the future in precise detail from Daniel's day down to 70 A.D. So now, in chapter 10, we saw that there's an angelic being that is sent to explain these things to Daniel. He's fighting with the prince of Persia. So we worked through those things last week. But let's just take a look again at verse 14 in chapter 10. Now I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people, those are Daniel's people, the Jews, in the latter days. I pointed out, literally that means end of the days. It is the end of the Mosaic Covenant days. It's the end of the Jewish people being the chosen people of God days. The vision pertains to those days. All these things are wrapping up in that time period, one chapter after another, and now we have three chapters that are devoted to this, and we'll end in that same place. So then, we came through chapter 10 all the way until we get to 11. In 11, this individual, we've had a handful introduced now, but the individual that's been speaking there in chapter 11 says in verse 1, in the first year of Darius the Mede, that would be likely, a few years either side, but 539 B.C., I rose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. Now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. Back in chapter 7, Medes and Persians are named, as is Greece. They are identified as representing that ram and that goat. We have the names printed before they will come to power and before they'll come to power, for more than 100 years. And so, here's Greece again. It really is undeniable. We are being told what will happen on the earth among physical kingdoms because God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, last week I handed out this historical outline. I believe if you were not here or for some reason don't have one, you'll find some of these on the table in the foyer. I believe we have some left over, and if when you leave you don't have one of those, find and ask me or send me an email and I'll get one for you. But what this is the work of Jim McGuigan, who, like all the other commentators, has simply looked at the history that we now live on the other side of, and he's identified verse by verse the names and a little bit of the activities, which I've greatly edited so that you can have this and slip it into your Bible. So take, for instance, in verse 2. On the chart that I handed out next to chapter 11 and verse 2, it says, number 1 is Cambyses, number 2 is Darius the First Hystaspes, number 3 is Smyrnus, number 4 is Xerxes. Xerxes is renowned in history for his wealth. This is exactly how he gained his power, through his wealth. The verse describes the man long before he'll, have this power, but there certainly is the fulfillment of it. Then in verse 3, a mighty king will arise, and he'll rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. Who's that? It's Alexander the Third, also known as Alexander the Great. How old is he when he dies? 33. Is he back home ruling over a kingdom, or is he still out trying to conquer the world? Still out conquering the world. What happens to his wife and son? They're murdered. Who winds up with his kingdom? How many guys? 4 of them, parceled out the four points of heaven, just like we saw in chapter 7. It's a separate vision. It's Daniel's vision. It knocked him flat. He had to be lifted back up off his face in the dust. It was so overwhelming. Now he's being given additional information to what we had in chapter 10. But as you look at the chart again, at 11:4, these men are Lysimachus, Antipater, Seleucus the First, and Ptolemy the First. The Seleucids in the north, often referred to as the Syrian kingdom, though they're occupying Turkey as well, and the Ptolemies in the south, occupying Egypt and parts of Arabia. These are the four that Alexander's kingdom is parceled into. And now, in verse 6, five, then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. So in verse 5, we have a king of the south who's going to have great dominion. In the south are the Ptolemies. In the north are the Seleucids. Then they had this disagreement, had this split in verse 5. Ptolemy is the stronger one. He's the king of the south. Ptolemy the First, going to start a dynasty, going to last for a very long time. Then it's just Ptolemy 1, Ptolemy 2, Ptolemy 3, all the way through 6. Now in verse 6, after some years, they will form an alliance. The daughter of the king of the south, Ptolemies, will come to the king of the north, Seleucids, to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up, along with those who brought her in, and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. So at verse 6 in McGuigan's work, Berenice is the daughter now of Ptolemy the Second. The dynasty is marching through time. She marries Antiochus the Second Theos, who's that Seleucid king. He had divorced his wife Laodice. Laodice's not very happy about it. She poisons both of them and their baby. Okay, kind of a tough ending, but that's what verse 6 is about. Now, obviously, nobody has enough marginal references or space to try and write these references down. So the chart I handed out is just immensely important to me. I've had it for many, many years. Keep one in my Bible. I really want to lean on that a lot tonight. Every one of these stories is just astonishingly interesting. This is why there's an Encyclopedia Britannica. This is why, you know, there are colleges. This is why, you know, we have a whole academic world is studying history. This history is extremely well known, attested by large numbers as we go through the whole chapter of various historians who lived in these times or wrote after these times. And so absolutely every single thing that Daniel foresaw and foretold is written in detail by uninspired authors through the ages. And it's all fascinating, but we've, you know, have not the time to delve into it. So I'm going to give you just two little, you know, snippets as we go through tonight to just, you know, fill in the blanks a little bit. But, you know, it's fascinating stuff because it just says so much about God and his representatives and their ability to foretell the future. So we'll just leave that there, but that is how it went down in verse 6. Now we'll take 7 and 8. But one of the descendants of her line, she's been murdered, will arise in his place, and he'll come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. In the north, what's the dynasty? Seleucids. He'll deal with them and display great strength, and also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. He'll take into captivity to Egypt. That's the king of the south. What's their dynastic name? Ptolemies. All right. And he, on his part, will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. So in 7 and 8, on the cheat sheet, you find out this now is the third Ptolemy. He is also called Yergetes. It's Berenice's brother. He defeats Seleucus II, Callinicus, who was that son of Laodice. And she's out poisoning, you know, everybody. And so it is fulfilled exactly as it was outlined in advance. Verse 9, then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. So Seleucus II, he counterattacks and gets whooped again. In 10, his sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. Now, obviously, as we go through time, some kings last a long time, some kings last a little, some are powerful, some are weak. You know, you've got all these different circumstances. Everyone is outlined in your cheat sheet. Seleucus III, Antiochus II, then Seleucus IV, they're waging war till Antiochus III comes raging through. You know, he gains the upper hand for a while, and that brings us to 11 and 12. Then the king of the south will be enraged, and he'll go forth and fight with the king of the north, and the latter will raise a great multitude, but the multitude will be given into the hand of the former. Now this is Ptolemy IV in verse 11. He defeats Antiochus at a place called Raphia in 217 B.C. Now I've been thinking I need to go back and for my own notes in my Bible and probably to rework this sheet, you know, put more of the actual dates in there. But this is the one, 11, you see, chapter 11, verses 11 and 12. It's 217 B.C. We have manuscripts that are extant today that date back to 250 B.C. So Daniel's living in 530s. He's writing about events that will take place in 217. And those who argue that he's just a liar who lived sometime, you know, later, you know, have to answer. How then do we have manuscripts that are older than that? So just the manuscripts that we have at 250 would be 33 years prior to this battle at Raphia. And also tied to that is verse 12. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up. He'll cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. Antiochus loses. No matter how hard he tries, it's sure going to be costly. Tens of thousands. Verse 13, the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former. After an interval of some years, he'll press on with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. So you see in your notes, there were Jews that allied themselves with Antiochus III against Ptolemy V. Now, all of this plays out in history. Brethren, if you have kings in the north, and they are the what? Seleucids in what two major areas? Syria and what we today would call Turkey. Then you have the kings of the south, and they're the what? Ptolemies, and that's Egypt and Arabia. What lies between those two kingdoms? Israel. And the Mediterranean Sea. Okay? So if you're going to bring soldiers, you either have to build a whole lot of really big boats and risk the problems that go with, you know, naval activities in those days, or where are you going to bring your armies? Back and forth through Israel. Israel is always a part of this. Israel is always in the middle. Israel suffers horribly throughout all this time. First the Seleucids are reigning over them, then the Ptolemies, and then it reverses, and then it reverses. And they're just being ravaged as these years are going by. Does Daniel really ultimately care about Seleucus III and Ptolemy IV and, you know, whether or not somebody gets whooped in 217 B.C.? Who's he care about? His people, the Jews. So don't forget the Jews when you're hearing all of this going on. The Jews are going to play a role in here. We're going to be reading about them shortly. But as Daniel is given this information, it is the world history of the entire Mediterranean area for centuries to come. So now, we have the Jews ally themselves with one group, ally with the other. What's the whole Old Testament about? Well, maybe the Assyrians will help us, you know, maybe they won't. Maybe the Egyptians will help us, maybe they won't. We've seen all this before. It's just the way the world works. But foretelling the future is not a thing most people can do. Daniel is a prophet of God. Then in 15, the king of the north will come, cast up a siege mound, capture a well-fortified city. The forces of the south will not stand, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases. No one will be able to withstand him. He'll stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. So what's the beautiful land? Is that the north or the south? It's Israel, isn't it? See, I thought I could throw you off that saber she gets me every time. It's not the north. It's not the south. It's Daniel's people. So they've already showed up and failed in their alliance. Here he is again, this guy now, in verses 15 through 17, it's Antiochus III. He takes Sidon just to the north and then Palestine as well. He gives his daughter Cleopatra. Now, I changed this today. As a matter of fact, I noted that there's more than one Cleopatra. If you want to write it in there somehow, I should have put Cleopatra the First. In the editing I did for my own sake today, I didn't print it. But that's Cleopatra the First, not the one you all know because she looks so much like Elizabeth Taylor. Okay, this is the first. We'll get to Elizabeth later. It's Ptolemy the Fifth as a peace offering, but it all fails. So now we come to 18. Well, I didn't read 17. He'll set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he'll put into effect. But he'll also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. But she will not stand for him or be on his side. And once again, these are all machinations, you know, that go on, as has long been the case in world history, of trying to make peace and gain advantage by marrying off warring people's children. The kings make alliances. My son, marry your daughter, see, and I love her, so I'm not going to be attacking you guys. This kind of stuff goes on all the time. Sometimes it's fairly effective. Sometimes it's not. So use the cheat sheet. You know, that'll give you the information right there. In verse 18, Antiochus III takes Asia Minor, Thrace, and Greece in 197, 196, and 192, respectively. But he's defeated, and here come the Romans at Thermopylae and Magnesium in 191 and 190. So when it says in 18, he'll turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. Now, brethren, that's a single verse, but it covers about 7 or 8 years. And so, you know, go to the Britannica now that you have the cheat sheet. You know, I mean, go online and get everything in the Britannica for free now. All those poor salesmen years ago going door to door, you know, now you can just go online and get it. But you can read in detail any one of these things that you like. Now, 19, he'll turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but he'll stumble and fall and be found no more. Everybody dies, brethren. So when you read about stumbling, falling, and all that, you know, everybody dies. Eventually, that are gone. So Antiochus III, in verse 19, finally goes home and passes away. We come then to verse 20. Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he'll be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. Well, in verse 20 on your cheat sheet, Seleucus now the fourth, Philopater is also called, sends Heliodorus to tax the Jews. The Jews are woven through this history. They're not in every verse, but they're essentially in every event. So here they are. He is then killed by Heliodorus. So it's not a big battle, it's just an assassination that takes place. Now we come to verse 21. In his place, a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Now this is tremendously important in biblical history, Antiochus IV. Antiochus IV has a nickname. All these men have to have an individual name. And so, what's the one, you can use your cheat sheet if you like, that we attach to Antiochus IV? He is Antiochus Epiphanes. What is an epiphany?
An awakening.
We say awakening, but what's the idea behind the word? An epiphany is to see God. He's calling himself the very what? I am the epiphany. When you're looking at me, you're looking at God. The man was a raging madman, power hungry, brutal. And I have to lean on the knowledge you already have, or I assume you have, about this man. He's the guy we've already read about in these earlier chapters just before us who will cause the sacrifice to cease. He's the great defiler of the temple, slaughtered a pig on it, engaged in all sorts of sexual bacchanalia in that temple, doing everything he could to defile Solomon's temple. It is as a result of him that the Hasmonean family is going to rise up. They'll be hammering on him, with guerrilla warfare. So they will be dubbed the Maccabees, which means the hammer. And all of that, history between the Testaments and this warfare that goes on and how he eventually fails is the time frame that you've now come to. So in verse, I lost my own place here. We're at 1121. In 1121, this despicable person is Antiochus IV Epiphanes. In 22, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered. Also the Prince of the Covenant. And after an alliance is made with him, he'll practice deception. He'll go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he'll enter the richest parts of the realm. He'll accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He'll distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them. He'll devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. And he'll stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food, so you would think they would be his friends, will destroy him. We always laugh and joke, songs have been written, it's good to be king. It's only good to be king if what? You can survive it. And most other ways, it's terrible to be king. Everybody wants to kill you. So, those who eat his choice food will destroy him, his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will speak lies at the same table. So they sit down and negotiate and just lie to each other. But it will not succeed, for the end is still at the appointed time. Now we've had an end to the Jewish people that's been mentioned already in this book. I gave you several highlights at the start. That end is still coming. Daniel is still being led to that end. This prophecy is going to end with that end. So we're coming to those things. But in 28, he'll return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. At the appointed time, You see how much is being devoted to this man? How many verses? Is Antiochus big in Jewish history? He's gargantuan. So he'll return, he'll come into the south, but this last time, it'll not turn out the way it did before. For, in verse 30, ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened, will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant, Daniel's people, take action so he'll come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, this is all 168 B.C. now. You can see I've been skipping over the reading here. We've got to get on to some other things. But this is all Antiochus the Fourth down all the way through 33, where, starting in 68 and 67, he's really angry. And he goes through all of this that we've just been talking about. He's the guy you've heard about who defiles the temple with the pigs and the Hasmoneans, everything that I just said. Now, this will be the first of only two times where I just want to take a minute. There's a historian by the name of Livy, L-I-V-Y, is how everybody refers to it. It's just Livy. His actual name was Titus Livius in the Latin. He's born in about 60 B.C. in Italy. He dies in A.D. 17. So he's a historian for the Romans who spans the time of the birth of Christ. Now, here's a quote from him in book 45 of his History of Rome. Quote, Antiochus the Fourth marched by easy stages toward Alexandria. That is an enormously important city, number two in all the realm of what kingdom? Egypt. So a king of the south, which would be what dynasty? Ptolemies. So it says, after crossing the river at Eleusis, about 4 miles from Alexandria, he was met by the Roman commissioners. Rome is now on the rise. Kings of south, kings of north. But who's to the west? Italy, Rome. And here they come. Nebuchadnezzar saw a statue that involved them. We've had several chapters now since chapter 7 that have been giving us to understand about this history. So then Livy continues, he was met by the Roman commissioners to whom he gave a friendly greeting and held out his hand to Popilius Lanus. That's the Roman. Ships of Kittim means islands of Rome, Cyprus chief among them, but the other islands as well in both biblical history and other. So Antiochus IV puts out his hand to shake this newcomer. He's not a king of the south. He's not a king of the north. It's Rome coming in from the west, but gaining so much power that they can now insert themselves into this long time war going on between these two dynasties, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Popilius, however, placed in his hand the tablets on which were written the decree of the Senate and told him first of all to read that. So here's Antiochus with his hand out, liar at the table, you know, all this, always by intrigue, puts out his hand to be a friend, and what's he get? Tablets. So after reading it through, Antiochus said he would call his friends into council and consider what he ought to do. Continuing the reading with Livius, Popilius, stern and imperious as ever, drew a circle around the king with the stick he was carrying. And he said, before you step out of that circle, give me a reply to lay before the Senate. What is the expression that's been going on since about 168 B.C. that is drawn from that event? What did he do? He drew a line in the sand. You can think about all you want, as long as you give me an answer when. Before you step out of that circle. This guy is not, he's not bargaining. He's not negotiating. What kind of power does Rome think it has now? A lot. They got a Senate. They're serious stuff. And they decided, we're coming now. And we're going to take care of you both. So, for a few minutes, Antiochus hesitated, astounded at such a peremptory order, and at last replied, I will do what the Senate thinks right. Not till then did Popilius extend his hand to the king as a friend and ally. Antiochus evacuated Egypt at the appointed date. Now, has he been humiliated or what? Yeah. And where does he go from Egypt? Who are the first people he meets that he can stomp on? So what's he do? This is a guy who got out of the circle. And now he wants to exert, you know, some sort of power. And so it appears that, you know, all of the stuff that he did to those Jews is at least likely motivated largely by the rage he's feeling at this colossal failure that he's just experienced. So that's taking us now, of course, all the way down through verses 30, and then I'll start at 31. Forces will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, do away with the regular sacrifice, set up the abomination of desolation. By smooth words, he'll turn to godlessness, those who act wickedly toward the covenant. So, not everybody was a Maccabean. Some people just surrendered, rolled over, and said, okay, we give up. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. I'd suggest, you know, 2,300 evenings and mornings, which would be 1,150 days. We talked all about that, you know, in an earlier chapter. So now, we come to 34. Now, when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy, and some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the... There we go again. Because it is still to come at the what? The appointed time. By this time in Daniel, you should be getting used to hearing about this final obliteration of God's people. They go through some tough stuff. They bounce back. But eventually will come the day when there will be no more bounce. And this prophecy is going to take us there. So we keep getting reminded. Despite all the stuff that happens, in 164 BC, did the Maccabeans win or lose? They won. They took the temple back. They cleansed it. And to this day, the Jews, with, you know, exclamation, quotes, the Jews of today, falsely so-called, these people are celebrating what holiday that's tied to that? Hanukkah, Feast of Lights, 164 BC, when Antiochus finally loses after the preceding prophecies, evening and morning sacrifices are fulfilled. Now, 36. Then the king will do as he pleases. Now, brethren, we got a problem here. From this point on, what are we talking about? It's Romans for sure, but who? So if you look at your notes, I've been very careful, you know, at the top it says, mostly from the book of Daniel by Jim McGiggin. This is Jim McGiggin's material. So look at your cheat sheet now, 36 through 39, Octavian. Also called Augustus Caesar, rises to power in Rome. He defeats Cleopatra number 2, Lizzie, and Mark Antony at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. Herod the Great welcomes Octavian, also known as Augustus, to Jerusalem. Parthians are east, Germans and Gauls were north of Rome in 44, we'll get there in a minute. And after 45 years as emperor, Octavian dies in Rome in 14 AD. Now, verses 36 to the end of this chapter, brethren, are kind of tough because we know Augustus is in there for some of it. 40 through 43, we'll read in a moment, has to be Augustus, also known as Octavian. But unhappily, the words here seem to fit both him and Herod the Great. So it's a little bit tough to pick between the two. At this point, I am at variance with McGiggin's work. This is McGiggin's work. But I prefer a commentator by the name of Philip Mauro. M-A-U-R-O. M-A-U-R-O. He wrote The 70 Weeks and the Great Tribulation almost 100 years ago, just a year away. Now, that book is the best commentary I know on all this material. He strongly suggests that because it says the king, does not name north or south, Papilius was not a king. Rome still had a senate. Augustus, you know, he's coming here now, but, you know, they're in the time of the Senate and then leading into Augustus. He suggests and convinces me that this king is Herod the Great now. We've come down to his time, which is simultaneous with Augustus. I think it's Herod in 36 that does as he pleases, exalts and magnifies himself above every god, speaks monstrous things against the God of gods, will prosper until the indignation is finished. Now it's him and his dynasty. These various Agrippas and whatnot that we, Philip, that you hear about in the New Testament are all Herod's. They're his sons and grandsons. It's his dynasty now. So, you know, against God and gods, he'll prosper until the indignation is finished. The indignation that is the time that's still to come, that is the shattering of the power of Daniel's people. So, it says, he'll prosper until the indignation is finished, for which is decreed will be done. 37, he'll show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he'll magnify himself above them all. Now, won't show any regard for women. Herod liked women. He had about 10 wives. We're not talking about sexuality here. Augustus liked women. He was married. Okay? Desire of women, that doesn't have to be exclusively reserved as a man's lust for a woman sexually. What is every Jewish woman of the times' towering desire? What does every Jewish woman want to be? I say every, in a certain lineage, in a certain tribe. What does she want to be? She wants to be the mother of the Messiah. Herod's not going to care about that. He's not going to care about their desire. As a matter of fact, when the wise men come and say that the desire of those women has been born, and we know her name is Mary, what does Herod do? He tries to kill him in Bethlehem with the murder, we say, of the innocents. So, that's what I think this is about. And Malro, if you'll take the time to read him, will help you with all of that. He spends, I think it's 24 pages on the topic. It's 23. Okay, in verse 38. Instead, he will honor a god of fortresses. Who among all men in ancient history built fortresses? Who built Masada? Who built the Herodium? Who built Jerusalem? Who built Jericho? Who was the greatest builder of this time? Herod. And what was he building? Well, he built a temple. But he was building fortresses. It fits him so well, and really not like Augustus at this point. So, he will instead honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He'll honor with gold and silver, costly stones and treasures. He'll take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Is he a full-blooded Jew? No, he's an Idumean. So he's got rivalries and split thoughts, you know, about gods. He'll give great honor to those who acknowledge him. He'll cause them to rule over the many, and he'll parcel out land for a price. I think it's Herod. Now, in 40, please make a note. The New American Standard says collide. That is not the only way to translate this. This word that is translated collide, at that end time, the king of the south will collide with him. Well, we don't have that happening with Herod. But there's another way to translate that word. So make a note. The other way to translate this is push. Herod enters into an alliance with Augustus. And he's pushing with Augustus. So we can have Augustus now in 40 through 43 preeminently. We can also have Herod on his side because by this time he has joined forces with Augustus. So it says, at the end time, the king of the south will push with him. The king of the north will storm against him with chariots, horsemen, many ships. He'll enter countries, overflow, and pass through. He'll also enter the beautiful land. This is Augustus now, and that's the Jews again. And he did. It's recorded that he came. Many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand. Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. That's exactly what happened in the history. Those three groups escaped the heavy hand of Rome under Augustus. Then he'll stretch out his hand against these countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. So, as I understand it, brethren, 36 through 39 are especially Herod. Then we have Herod after, then I'm going to read about, and he joins forces with Augustus and is pushing with him. Now he's on Augustus' side. And then we're going to come back, 44 and 45, we'll be talking about Herod again. Now, let me read this, though. This is from Josephus in what is called Antiquities of the Jews. You're all used to me reading Wars of the Jews. This is Antiquities of the Jews. Book 15, chapter 6. I'm going to give you excerpts from paragraphs 5 through 7. We're talking about Cleopatra II. We're talking about Mark Antony fighting against Augustus, culminating in a naval battle at Actium that is Cleopatra's fault because Antony didn't want to do it. But the foolish man fell in love. That'll get you in trouble every time. So he listens to Cleopatra and decides he's going to fight Rome on the water. And they're utterly defeated and both of them wind up committing suicide. You've all seen the plays in the movies. Okay? This is what we're talking about, this time frame. But first, Herod was on Antony's side. He sided with Cleopatra and Antony. And then they went down. Now what's he going to do? Augustus is on top. And I was the compadre to his enemy. So here's Josephus, book 15, chapter 6, excerpts from paragraphs 5 through 7. After Antony had been beaten at the Battle of Actium by Caesar Augustus, both Herod's enemies and friends despaired of his affairs, for it was not probable that he would remain without punishment since he had shown so much friendship for Antony. Herod made haste to Rhodes to meet Caesar, and when he had sailed to that city, he took off his diadem but reduced nothing else of his usual dignity. When meeting Augustus, he did not resort to supplications or petitions, as if he were an offender, as men usually do upon such occasions, but in an undaunted manner gave an account of what he had done. He spoke thusly to Caesar. Now here's what Josephus records Herod said. How he would have access to this, or if he's just kind of, you know, filling in the blanks, we don't know. But here's what Josephus said that Herod said after his Mark Antony had been defeated and he rushes out to meet the new Caesar here. He says, "I had the greatest friendship for Antony and did everything I could that he might attain the government. I was not indeed in the army with him, but I sent him both money and corn. For if a man owns himself to be another's friend, he's obliged to use every faculty of his soul, members of his body, and all the wealth he has for his friend. I have not deserted him upon his defeat at Actium, nor upon the evident change of his fortune have I transferred my hopes from him to another. I demonstrated to him that the only way he had to save himself and not to lose all his authority was to slay Cleopatra. For when she was once dead, there would be room for him to retain his authority." Now, I'm leaving out a bit where it says he wouldn't take my advice. "Now, therefore, in case you judge me according to your anger at Antony, there's no room for me to deny what I've done. But if you will put him out of the case and only examine how I behave myself to my benefactors and what sort of a friend I am, you will find that I shall do the same for you. For 'tis but changing the names and the firmness of friendship that we shall bear to you will not be disproved by you." End of the quote. Josephus continues, "By this speech and by his behavior, he greatly impressed Caesar. Accordingly, Augustus restored to Herod his diadem, encouraged Herod to exhibit himself as great a friend to Caesar as he had been to Antony, and then held him in great esteem. Everybody loves this story. Smart, cunning, courageous. Okay? And now he's pushing with Augustus, like he had been pushing with Antony. See that? Okay. Fortunately for me, the elders have said, I can have another class. So I'm playing my get out of jail free card right now. Okay. Next week, we'll take up the rest of this then. I'd hope to get through it all, but you know, it's so hard to leave this history aside. It's just so magnificent. So we're just going to close right here now with 44 and 45. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him. I think it's back to Herod now. He'll go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. And he'll pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Now, what that would suggest is that Herod, with his palaces, and this is the case, winds up with a couple of palaces, as a matter of fact, that are between the Mediterranean Sea and what sea? The Dead Sea. Okay? Yet, will come to his end, and no one will help him. So we'll flesh out a little bit more on chapter 11 next week. We'll take the 13 verses of chapter 12, which are, admittedly, got some tough stuff in it, and then we'll bring it all to a close. Greg, you had a comment? Yeah, I didn't. But I will next week. So we'll handle all the abomination of desolation stuff next week. All right, any other comment or question? Yeah.